Chapter 61. On a rocky beach of Santa Barbara Island, an elephant seal awoke from a leisurely nap and cocked an ear towards the inland. The odd sound of cheering wafted down the hillside from 30 or so men congregated on a small bluff. The seal looked quizzically up at the disheveled group of men, then stretched back out and resumed his nap. For the first time in their lives, the sea launch platform crew of technicians and engineers were happy to witness a launch failure. Men cheered and whistled, while others poked their fists in the air in celebratory victory. As the launch vehicle blew up above their heads, even Cristiano grinned a sigh of relief as platform launch manager Oroga slapped him on the back. "Somebody was smiling down on us for once," Oroga said. "Thank God. Whatever those bastards were trying to launch could not have been good." One of my flight engineers noted a roll oscillation right from launch. Must have been a nozzle adjustment malfunction or a stabilization issue with the platform. Cristiano thought of Pitt and his comment before departing the Odyssey. Maybe that fellow from Numa worked some magic. If so, we owe him big. Yes. And somebody owes me, too, Cristiano replied. Oroga looked at the captain quizzically. That was a $90 million launch vehicle that just went up in flames. There will be hell to pay when we pass that bill to the insurer, the captain said, finally letting loose a laugh. Kang flinched as he watched the satellite feed of the Zenit disintegrate before his eyes. As the camera caught pieces of falling debris, he silently reached for the remote control and turned off the monitor. Though the strike has failed, the specter of the attack will still represent a serious provocation to the American public, Kwan assured his boss. Anger will be high, and the fallout against Japan significant. Yes, our staged media security leaks should ensure that, Kang said, suppressing his anger at the failure. But the disappearance of the Goguryeo and launch team remains at hand. Their capture would corrupt much of our hard work to date. Tongju will fulfill his duties. He always has, Kwan replied. Kang stared at the darkened television monitor for a moment, then slowly nodded. The mood in the Koguryo's launch control center quickly turned from joy to shock to sullen disappointment. In an instant, the mission requirements of the launch team fell away, and the assembled technicians and engineers sat silently at their computer stations, staring at the displays that no longer provided any launch data. No one seemed to know what to do next, and whispered quietly with one another. Tongju threw a long, frigid glare towards Ling, then left the control center without saying a word. As he made his way towards the bridge, he called Kim on a portable radio and spoke briefly in a low voice. On the bridge, he found Captain Lee staring out the starboard bridge window at the smoke-trailed rain of debris that scarred the blue sky with white strips of vapor. She shook herself apart, he said with wonder, then looked into the blank eyes of Tongju. A problem with the platform, Tongju replied. We must evacuate the area immediately. Can we get moving at once?
We are standing by for departure. We just need to hoist in the tender, then we can be underway.
There is no time, he hissed suddenly. The American Coast Guard and Navy may already be looking for us. Proceed under full power at once, and I will personally cut the tender loose.
Lee looked at Tongju warily, then nodded.
As you wish. Our course is already laid in. We shall make for Mexican waters, then divert under cover of darkness for the rendezvous position.
Tongju took a step to exit the bridge, then stopped suddenly. Out of the forward window, he gazed at the smoke-enshrouded sea launch platform. Approaching the platform from the northwest was the silver blimp, now cruising several hundred feet above the water. Tongju waved an arm in the direction of the Icarus.
Alert your surface-to-air missile team. Take out that airship immediately, he spat, then vanished out the door.
As the Koguryeo's twin four-bladed propellers began churning the water beneath the ship's hull, Tongju hustled his way back to the portable stairwell that ran down the vessel's port flank. At the base of the stairwell bobbed the white tender, a mooring line tied across to the railing. He noted bubbles of smoke rising from the boat's stern, alerting him that the engine was running at idle. Quickly untying the line, he coiled it in his hand and waited until the next passing wave pushed the tender up against the side of the ship. With barely a step, he hopped aboard the bow of the boat and shuffled towards the cabin, tossing the coiled line into an empty bucket on deck. Inside the cabin, he found Kim and two of his commandos standing beside the wheel. "Everything aboard?" Tongju asked. Kim nodded. "During the excitement of the launch, we moved our arms and provisions on board, and even hoisted extra fuel aboard without any interference." Kim tilted his head towards the rear open deck, where 4 55-gallon drums of gasoline were tied off against the gunwale. "Let us drift off the stern for a moment. Then we shall make our run to Ensenada. When will the charges detonate?" Kim glanced at his watch. "In 25 minutes. Plenty of time for the missile crew to destroy the airship." The Koguryo quickly churned away from the small boat as the tender continued to idle in the low swells. When the former cable ship had cleared a quarter mile of open water, Kim moved the throttles to slow and crept forward with the bow pointed southeast. In no time, he figured, they would look like another ordinary fishing charter heading home to San Diego. Long after the Zenit had climbed into the sky and detonated, a thick cloud of white smoke still hung over the Odyssey like a fog bank. Ever so gently, the light sea breeze began poking holes through the exhaust, revealing sporadic patches of the launch platform through the haze. "Looks like a bowl of clam chowder down there," Giordino said as he banked the Icarus over the platform. While Giordino and Dahlgren visually surveyed the platform for any signs of pit, Dirk activated the lash system and scanned for optical anomalies that might signify a human being. "Don't quote me, but I think that baby is sinking," Dahlgren said as they glided around the aft end of the platform and could make out an exposed section down to the water. The men in the gondola could clearly see that the aft support columns appeared shorter than the bow columns. "She's definitely taking on water in the stern," Dirk replied. "Wonder if that's the handiwork of your old man. He may have just cost somebody a new rocket," Giordino said. "And maybe a new launch pad," Dahlgren added. "But where is he?" Dirk asked aloud. They could all detect that there was no apparent sign of life on the platform. "The smoke is starting to clear. Once the helipad opens up, I'll take us in for a closer look," Giordino replied. As they drifted back towards the bow of the platform, Dahlgren looked down and grimaced. "Damn. The Badger's gone, too. Must have sank during the launch." The threesome fell quiet, reflecting that the disappearance of the submersible was the least of their losses. 3 miles to the south, a gunnery crewman on the Koguryo was transferring the radar-derived coordinates of the blimp into a Chinese CSA-4 surface-to-air missile guidance system. The slow-moving airship was as easy an objective as the gunnery crew could ever hope to target. With such a large object at close range, the odds of failing to strike the blimp were nearly zero. In an enclosed room adjacent to the dual missile canister, a weapons control expert stood at a console, transferring the firing guidance through a missile command link. A row of green lights flashed at him as the engagement radar embedded in the missile acknowledged a target lock. The man immediately picked up a telephone receiver that ran directly to the bridge. "Target acquired and missile armed," he said in monotone to Captain Lee. "Awaiting orders to fire." Lee looked out a bridge side window towards the blimp hovering over the platform in the distance. The high-powered missile exploding into the airship would make for a spectacular display, he thought childishly. Perhaps they should also destroy the distant turquoise vessel that lingered on the edge of their radar screen and then make a clean escape. But first things first. He moved the receiver to his mouth to issue the command to fire when suddenly his lips froze. His eyes had detected a small pair of dark objects emerging from behind the airship. He stood frozen and watched as the objects quickly materialized into a pair of low-flying aircraft. The F-16D Falcon fighter jets had been scrambled from an Air National Guard base in Fresno minutes after a NORAD satellite had detected the launch of the Zenit rocket. While flying towards the launch site, the Coast Guard distress call that had originated from the Deep Endeavor helped direct the pilots to the Koguryo. The sleek gray jets flew low above the water and burst over the Koguryo just a few hundred feet above her forebridge. The crackling roar of the jets' engines struck a second after their shadows had whisked by overhead, rattling the windows of the bridge where Lee stood with a sickened look on his face.
"Stand down! Stand down and secure the battery!" he barked over the phone.
As the SAM was stowed away, Lee watched as the two fighter jets gained altitude and began crisply circling the fast-moving ship.
"You,"
he cursed at a crewman standing nearby. "Find Tongju and bring him to the bridge. At once!" The men in the blimp beamed in relief at the sight of the Air National Guard jet circling above the Koguryo, having no idea how close they were to being blasted out of the sky by the ship's SAM battery. They knew that a horde of Navy ships was on the way and that there was little chance the ship would escape apprehension now. They again turned their attention to the smoke-covered platform below.
"The haze is lifting off the helipad," Giordino observed. "I'll set it down if you boys want to jump off and take a look around."
"Absolutely," Dirk replied. "Jack, we can start with the bridge, then move down to the hangar if the air is breathable."
"I'd start with the ship's lounge," Giordino said, trying to cut the somber mood. "If he's okay, my money says he's mixing a martini and eating up the ship's store of pretzels."
Giordino swung the blimp wide of the platform, bringing the airship around with its nose into the wind. As he lined up on the helipad and began dropping altitude, Dahlgren stuck his head back into the cockpit and pointed out the side window.
"Take a look over there," he said.
Several hundred feet off the side of the platform, a sudden surge of bubbles erupted from beneath the surface. A few seconds later, a mottled gray metallic object broke the surface.
"Launch debris?" Dahlgren asked.
"No, it's the Badger," Giordino exclaimed.
Guiding the airship towards the object, the three men could see that it was, in fact, the Numa submersible bobbing low in the water. The underwater vehicle's bright metallic paintwork had been cooked off in the launch blast, leaving its skin a dappled mix of primer and bare metal. The bow section was bent and mangled as if it had been involved in a head-on traffic accident. How the thing still managed to float was anybody's guess, but there was no denying it was the experimental submersible Dirk and Dahlgren had sailed to the platform. As Giordino brought the blimp down for a closer look, the three men were stunned to see the top hatch suddenly twist and pop open. A cloud of steaming vapor streamed from the open hatch as they looked on incredulously. For several agonizing seconds, their eyes hung glued to the hatch, hoping against hope. Finally, they saw the odd apparition of a pair of stockinged feet rise up and out of the hatch. A patch of dark hair then appeared, and they realized that the feet they observed were actually hands covered in a pair of socks. The stocking-wrapped hands, protected from the hot metal, quickly hoisted up the lean, racked body of their owner from the enclosed oven.
"It's Dad. He's okay," Dirk exclaimed with glaring relief.
Pitt climbed to his feet and swayed on the rocking sub, sucking in lungfuls of the cool ocean air. He was a haggard mass of blood and sweat, and his clothes stuck to him as if they were glued to his skin. But his eyes shined as he looked skyward and threw a jaunty wave to the men in the gondola.
"Going down," Giordino announced as he proceeded to guide the blimp down towards the sea until the gondola was skimming just inches above the waves.
With a deft touch, Giordino gently eased the blimp alongside the submersible. Pitt leaned down and secured the Badger's top hatch, then took a few steps and staggered into the open door of the gondola, where Dirk and Dahlgren grabbed his arms and yanked him safely aboard.
"I believe," he said to Giordino in a dry, parched voice, "I'll take that drink now."
Pitt slipped into the blimp's co-pilot seat and gulped down a bottled water as Al, Dirk, and Jack described the fiery disintegration of the Zenit rocket minutes before. While studying the vapor trails in the sky and eyeing the Koguryo fleeing in the distance, Pitt countered with a description of his drilling attack on the Odyssey's support columns and the tumultuous assault from the wake of the blastoff.
And here I had good money down that you were lolling about in the Odyssey's lounge nursing a martini, Giordino grumbled.
I was the one shaken and stirred, Pitt laughed.
Would have been baked alive when the Badger got jammed against the side pontoon, but I was able to manually force the rudder against the surge and broke free into cooler water. Even with the ballast tanks purged, it took me a while to surface until I got the bilge pump working. There's still a lot of water sloshing around inside, but she should stay afloat a while longer.
I'll radio Deep Endeavor and have her fish the Badger out once they've picked up the platform crew on Santa Barbara Island, Giordino replied.
I will have a furious sister on my hands if you first don't let her know you were safe, Dirk chided.
Summer nearly fell over when her father's voice crackled through the Deep Endeavor's radio, jokingly ordering a beer and a peanut butter sandwich.
We feared the worst, she gushed. What on earth happened to you?
It's a long story. Suffice it to say that the Scripps Institute isn't going to be too happy with my submarine driving skills, he said, leaving all on the bridge of the Deep Endeavor, scratching their heads.
As Giordino lifted the airship up off the water, Pitt noticed the F-16 circling the fleeing Koguryo.
Cavalry finally arrive? He asked.
Just moments ago.
The Navy has an armada headed this way as well. She's not going to get away.
Her tender is sure making haste, Pitt said, nodding towards a white speck to the south. Lost in the spectacle and confusion was the Koguryo's tender, which had slipped quietly away from her mothership and was now motoring south towards the horizon at high speed.
How do you know that's her tender? Giordino asked, squinting downrange.
Over here, Pitt replied, tapping the Westcam monitor. Pitt had been fooling around with the zoom lens while talking and happened to catch the speeding boat flash by. The focused image clearly showed it was the Koguryo's tender, which they had observed earlier.
The jets definitely aren't tracking her, Dirk said from the rear, noting the F-16 circling tightly around the Koguryo as she sailed further to the west.
Let's stay on her, Pitt stated.
She has nary a chance against our fleet wings aflutter, Giordino snarled, pushing the throttles to full and watching as the airspeed indicator crept slowly towards 50 knots.